Iran's president, who is on an official visit, that is, to Russia, says Tehran and Moscow can join hands to counter U.S. unilateralism. Saudi-led warplanes ratchet up raids on Yemen, striking the international airport in the capital Sana'a and the strategic port of Hodeidah. And the U.S. president ups the ante against Russia in his inauguration anniversary presser, vowing to impose the toughest sanctions on Moscow if Ukraine is invaded. Hello, everyone, and thanks for tuning in to World News. The Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi says there is no hindrance lying in the way of improvement of ties between Iran and Russia. He made the remarks in a meeting with his Russian counterpart, Vladimir Putin, in Moscow. During that meeting, the two sides also discussed ways to expand mutual relations in various sectors. Marina Kortanova has more.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi made an official visit to Moscow on Wednesday at the invitation of his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. This is the first trip to Russia by an Iranian president since 2017. During a meeting in the Kremlin, the two sides set for talks on mutual and regional issues.
We have no limitation for expansion and development of ties with Russia and are after establishment of strategic relations with Moscow. We can expand our relations in economy, trade on the political track. We are not talking about momentary relations. We are talking about a sustainable and strategic relationship.
For his part, the Russian president said Iran-Russia's relations have been constantly improving. He also acknowledged Tehran and Moscow's contribution to Syria's transition past the terrorist threats.
Thanks to our efforts, we have largely succeeded in helping the Syrian government overcome the threats posed by international terrorism. Now, of course, both you and us are concerned about the situation that is developing in Afghanistan. I would like to discuss all these issues with you to know your position on these problems. And of course, it is very important for me to know your position on the JCPOA.
Iran's Raisi underlined that his country will never give in to the West's pressure, including the U.S., adding that Iran is seeking to remove the U.S. illegal and unilateral sanctions.
We have been confronting the U.S. for more than 40 years. We hope that these efforts would lead to removal of the sanctions. The threat of sanctions cannot come in the way of Iran's progress.
Ahead of the visit of Iran's Raisi to Moscow, Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian said that his country followed a new roadmap to deepen ties with Moscow, adding that Iran and Russia were determined to update a 20-year cooperation treaty that they signed in 2001.
This is Iranian president's third foreign trip since taking office in July last year. The visit is seen by observers as the latest efforts by Iran and Russia to cement stronger ties amid U.S. hostile policies towards both countries. Marina Kartunova, Moscow.
Iran and the three European signatories to the 2015 deal, also known as a Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, have held talks today in the Austrian capital. Our Vienna correspondent, Homa Lezgi, joined us earlier with an update. Now, she said Iran has expressed readiness to comply with JCPOA commitments once the country is assured sanctions will be removed in a verifiable manner.
But what we know from sources close to the talks is that at the moment there are still some sticking points, both when it comes to the issue of the list of sanctions that need to be removed by the Americans and also on the issues of verification and guarantees, how the sanctions removal can be effectively verified for Iran and how the U.S. can give guarantees to Iran that it will not withdraw from the deal again or reimpose sanctions once it is back in the JCPOA. And also there are still sticking points when it comes to the issue of implementation or sequencing. That would mean what actions, practical steps need to be taken by both Iran and the Americans to have the JCPOA restored. On the issue of sequencing, Iran has said time and again before, you might know, that it will only go back to its nuclear commitments after the effective removal of sanctions, after it has verified the removal of sanctions that need to be removed and are in violation of the JCPOA. We'll have to see if that can actually be achieved, but Iran has said that this is what it wants. What sources are saying is that at this stage, despite the fact that there are sticking points, besides it is possible for them to overcome these differences, they're saying that these are not insurmountable issues, they can be overcome, and if there is the political will to do so, an agreement could be possible, as Iran's foreign ministry spokesman said, at a good pace.
And now welcome everyone to the News Review program, where we get in-depth in one of the day's top stories. Iran's UN envoy says the deteriorating situation in occupied Palestinian territories poses a threat to international peace and security. In an address to the UN Security Council, Majid Taqdir Avanchi said UN inaction has emboldened Israel to continue its war crimes against the Palestinian people. He says perpetrators of such crimes must be brought to justice. The Iranian ambassador has called on the Council to oblige Israel to end its systematic violations of human rights and international humanitarian law. Taqdir Avanchi has rejected Israeli accusations that Iran is a threat to peace. He says Israel levels such allegations to distract attention from its brutalities against Palestinians. Joining us now for our program is Henry Herskovitz, anti-Israel peace activist from Ann Arbor, Michigan, and Paul Rudy from the Free Palestine Movement, joining us from Berkeley, California. Gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you both to the program. Paul, I guess we're going to start with you. Your thoughts on the Iranian ambassador that to the UN saying that, you know, it's really high time for Israelis to fall in line and basically secure the rights of Palestinians.
Well, it's always been that time, but Iran has a habit, and Taqdir Avanchi has a habit of speaking truth to power in this case, and this is what he's doing. Now, he has said that they have to, Israel and the perpetrators of crimes against the Palestinians have to be held to account. The question is, how do you hold them account? The United Nations has no independent force, no police force to do that. It is the Security Council that is charged with enforcement. And that's the stumbling block. It's always been the stumbling block. For those who speak truth, like Iran and like Taqdir Avanchi, Israel is a mortal enemy. They don't want the truth to be spoken, and so they would like to destroy Iran. That's another reason why they are diverting attention, if you will. They're doing more than diverting attention. They're trying to find a way to cause problems for those who speak the truth, like Iran.
Thank you, Paul. And Mr. Henry Herskovitz, welcome to the program, sir. Now, Henry, what's the point of a Security Council, to Paul's point, if it's not going to give Palestinians security, self-determination, human rights, basically, that the rest of the planet is pretty much entitled to under its own charter?
Well, first I'd like to shout out and say hi to Paul. The other thing I'd like to say is something that's so simple that it almost it's almost childlike. The community that most strongly supports Israel, the Jewish state, is the Jewish community. The United Nations is frozen in their tracks. Nobody wants to be called an anti-Semite. And everybody is so fearful of what I and others label Jewish power that they are stuck in their tracks, and they yearn for justice, but because it's the Jewish people committing these crimes against the Palestinian people. I mean, if it was any other group of people committing these crimes, these horrible crimes against Palestinians, I just read today about incarcerating Palestinian children in solitary confinement in a 3x3 cage or a cell. And if there was any other ethnic group tormenting and torturing and killing Palestinians, this the whole Palestinian situation, and most likely the Iranian situation, would be over yesterday. But because it's the Jewish state, and everybody is so afraid of confronting the Jewish state, that we're all, and I don't include me, and I don't include Paul, but most of us are just cowed by this pressure, this Jewish power that demands we remain silent. Last evening, in the Ann Arbor City Council, they were pressured by the Jewish community to pass a resolution condemning anti-Semitism. And like puppets on a string, like dogs on a leash, they passed this resolution unanimously. They particularly targeted our group that protests in front of a synagogue every Saturday morning. The reason we protest in front of a synagogue is because every member in that synagogue that goes in there supports Israel's right to exist as a Jewish state. And I don't know any Palestinian that supports Israel's claimed right to exist as a Jewish state. So I think the United Nations has to shake off these false claims of anti-Semitism, which now is even spelled differently due to the fact that Jewish power has changed a new style guide. New York Times fell in line just recently. So it's just an amazing feature of the world, who is fearful of treading on Jewish toes, and they shouldn't be, because collectively Jews are behaving horrendously. They're very worried about they claim an increase in anti-Semitism. Well, duh, you know, anti-Semitism always follows bad Jewish group behavior. And if you look at Jews in general and how they coalesce into state form in the state of Israel, well, my God, it's just outrageous that the world tolerates this. But because we've been conditioned by claims of unique Jewish suffering, over 300 Holocaust movies have been made in Hollywood. This is a Jewish problem. It's a world problem, and the world needs to grow a spine and stand up against this and say, enough. We're not going to, you know, the United States fought your war against Iraq. We're not going to fight your war against Iran. We have no quarrel. At least I have no quarrel with the state of Iran. And I think it should be left alone.
Gentlemen, that brings us to the close of this program. We're out of time. Thank you both for joining us on the program. Henry Herkowitz there, anti-Israel peace activist, joining us from Ann Arbor, Michigan. And Paul Rudy from the Free Palestine Movement, joining us from Berkeley, California. Thank you for tuning in, and goodbye for now. Foreign ministries of France, Germany, Italy, and Spain have urged Israel to stop the construction of new settlements in East Al-Quds. European countries say plan to construct hundreds of new buildings in East Al-Quds are a violation of international law. The four countries also expressed concern about the evictions and demolitions of Palestinian families in the neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah in Al-Quds. They described Israeli measures illegal under international law, adding that evictions and demolitions pose a risk of fueling tensions on the ground. UN Security Council has, in several resolutions, condemned Tel Aviv regime settlement projects in occupied Palestinian land. However, the Israeli regime does not heed such international calls. Saudi Arabia carries out fresh airstrikes, pounding several areas across its southern neighbor Yemen. Saudi warplanes have carried out six raids on Sana'a International Airport and its adjacent areas. They also hit the port city of Hodeidah and a number of other cities. This after the Yemeni army countered large-scale advance of mercenaries in its south. The army fired two ballistic missiles, killing and injuring more than 50 militants. Saudi Arabia, along with its allies, launched a devastating war on Yemen 7 years ago. Hundreds of thousands of Yemenis, mostly civilians, have been killed and millions displaced since then. Meanwhile, the U.S. president ups the ante against Russia in his inauguration anniversary presser, vowing to impose tough sanctions on Moscow if Ukraine is invaded.
And so I think what you're going to see is that Russia will be held accountable if it invades. And it depends on what it does. It's one thing if it's a minor incursion and then we end up having to fight about what to do and not do, etc. But if they actually do what they're capable of doing with the force amassed on the border, it is going to be a disaster for Russia if they further invade Ukraine, and that our allies and partners are ready to impose severe cost and significant harm on Russia and the Russian economy.
And Biden says his guess is that Russian President Vladimir Putin will launch an incursion into Ukraine. However, he notes Putin does not want a full-blown war. Biden warned that Russia will no longer be able to deal in dollars in case of an act of aggression. He added that Washington could work out a plan whether to station strategic weapons in Ukraine. Biden says it's unlikely Ukraine could join NATO in the near term as it still needed to work on democratic reforms. Political commentator Vladimir Goldstein says the Ukrainian crisis is primarily because the West disregards the fact that Russia's red line is NATO expansion toward its borders.
What has to be clear to your audience is that Russia is not interested in invading Ukraine. This is not in their strategic interest, not in their, in tactical interest. What they want to do is to sit with the West and ask them not to expand the NATO. And they keep on saying it in one terms, in another terms. And the West does want to face it. They do not want to face their absolutely aggressive and reckless politics, pushing NATO, spending too much money on armaments, on defense sector, channeling money away from regular projects to the military. So they need to come up with the story that Russia is aggressive. Russia is not interested in Ukraine. So just this is like totally red herring, and Biden knows it, and State Department knows it, and NATO knows it, but they keep on pushing it just because it helps and gullible public Biden. I find this very, very kind of silly and outrageous, but that's the way it is. This is not the first time, this is not the last time the West comes up with a red herring and starts chasing it.
Thank you for joining us, and goodbye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In Britain, one of the Conservative Party's most generous donors has called on Prime Minister Boris Johnson to resign and stand again for the Tory Party nomination amid growing calls from its backers for a change of leadership. The article you're about to hear has been written by The Guardian journalist Rajiv Sial. The piece is titled, Tory donor urges Boris Johnson to resign amid number 10 party scandals. Stay with us for more. In Britain, one of the Conservative Party's most generous donors has called on Prime Minister Boris Johnson to resign and stand again for the Tory Party nomination amid growing calls from its backers for a change of leadership. John Griffin, the taxi firm tycoon, who has given £4 million to the Tories since 2013, has become at least the fifth donor to publicly raise concerns over the Downing Street Party scandal. It comes as anger continues to simmer against the Prime Minister and his administration for repeatedly breaking COVID rules to hold parties in Downing Street while the rest of the country was in lockdown. A survey of grassroots Conservative supporters has found that 40% say that Boris Johnson should resign. John Griffin, the founder of Addison Lee, said Johnson should allow the party and voters to judge whether he is fit for office. "It is a shame. The whole situation has become comical. Boris Johnson has blotted his copybook and now needs to start again. I would like to see him resign and represent himself to the party and, if he gets the nomination, to the nation. We need a fresh start, otherwise this will go on forever," he said. John Griffin's comments follow statements from three backers this weekend who questioned Boris Johnson's role as leader of the Conservative Party. Peter Hargreaves, the Brexit-backing billionaire who gave £1 million to the Tories for the 2019 general election campaign, said he was very reluctant to continue supporting the party financially. Peter Hargreaves said he doesn't want to do good, he just wants to be Prime Minister. That's his only agenda. He changed from a Remainer to Brexit supporter specifically because it would give him a chance to be Prime Minister. As the Conservatives look now, I would be very reluctant to support them financially, Peter Hargreaves said. Hargreaves was one of three donors who voiced concern to the Sunday Times. Lord Michael Spencer, founder of the Next Group, formerly ICAP, Financial Interdealers Brokers, said, "I can't see how Boris Johnson can last. I really can't. He just hasn't changed and he won't change." The restaurateur Richard Caring, who gave more than £200,000 to the Conservative Party in 2019, told the newspaper, "He seems to have a death wish right now." John Cordwell, the Phones for You tycoon who gave the Conservative Party £500,000 ahead of the 2019 general election, called for Boris Johnson to clean up his administration or step aside. John Cordwell told BBC News last week, "It's the perceived arrogance, hypocrisy and rule-breaking that is impossible to justify. While the rest of us were striving to follow the ever-changing rules, including myself, even when I deemed them to be excessive at best and nonsensical at worst, those who were setting those rules were apparently freely and frequently disregarding them," he said. The latest figures from the Electoral Commission show that the Tories received £3.7 million in donations in the third quarter of 2021, double the amount received by the Labour Party over the same period. Other donors told The Guardian that they would make no fresh donations until Boris Johnson had gone. One who has given more than £100,000 since Boris Johnson became Conservative Party leader in 2019 said, "He has no morals. You need morals in the middle of an international pandemic." One former party treasurer said they did not think the current problems faced by Boris Johnson would result in a funding crisis for the Conservative Party. "There's always worries about where donations are coming from, but the main problem is raising money for an election, which is still probably a year or 2 years away. But I don't see this as being a run on the party's financing. This is a midterm crisis like all governments have, and I don't think it's panic time yet. Boris Johnson has this great power of recovery," he said. Meanwhile, there is massive anger among grassroots Conservative Party supporters over the Downing Street Party scandal. The head of a leading group has said, as its survey found, 40% thought that Prime Minister Boris Johnson should resign. Ed Costello, chairman of the grassroots Conservatives, said it had been years since the group last polled its supporters and followers, but it felt compelled by the unique nature of the public mood at present. Obviously, nobody is happy. There is massive anger, absolutely, and justifiably, said Ed Costello, adding that most people said they had written to their local MP or local Conservative Party branch to express their opinion. But some people said this is not necessarily the time to change the captain on the bridge. A lot of people have said they think he should go, but not yet. Conservative MPs reported being inundated with emails about the issue, with one describing the numbers as off the scale. A staffer said a lot of emails to their MP contained stories of personal hardship from new people, not the regulars. These were emails they would usually respond to as soon as possible, but it was difficult to do so while awaiting the findings of an inquiry by senior civil servant Sue Gray, they said. In some areas, anger spilled over into vandalism, with the constituency office of Derbyshire MP Robert Largan dubbed with word lies, according to pictures on Sunday. Last week, the office of another Conservative MP, Wellingborough MP Peter Bone, was graffitied with the word liar. Conservative associations across the country said members were growing increasingly frustrated and some were leaving the party in protest. If he doesn't go soon, we will lose all local elections that are coming up, or very many of them, and do immense damage to the party, said Anne Stribley, the chairwoman of Poole Conservative Association. Anne Stribley added, "We have had a number of members saying they can't continue to be members while Boris Johnson is there. It's been very difficult." A small minority have resigned.
I'm a teacher.
I'm a researcher.
I'm a mother.
I'm a lawyer.
And I believe in acting kindly toward you, because you are...
A Muslim lady.
You are very special. There's no one just like you. You are very special. And I'm so glad you're mine.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah. Dear listeners, thank you so very much for joining us again on today's brand new episode of Muslim Lady. In the studio with me, of course, I have the privilege and honor of being joined with my darling sister and excellent expert, Sister Razia Shamili. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam, my lovely sister Zainab.
Sister Razia, you drew out the image of a bewildered woman who is stuck at a crossroads, does not know what to do with the double
standards,
value systems that have been presented to her. On one hand, Islam says a bunch of things a woman should be, and the other hand, the secular society that she could be living in is expecting another bunch of things from her.
Mm-hmm.
And she doesn't know what to do. The solution, as you were saying this, I said in the previous show, I don't know if our listeners remember, that I don't understand what the confusion is. Why would you be confused? Just pick a side. Mm-hmm. Prioritize.
Exactly.
And that's when you gave the solution, which is just choose one value system.
Pick a side and prioritize are two different things.
How?
Pick a side, it means you choose one value system. So in the Islamic value system, your financial needs are taken care of by the men. Either your father, your husband. The men are fundamentally are supposed to take care of your financial needs.
Mm-hmm.
In the secular system, you have to yourself take care of your financial needs. You mm-hmm. are brought up in a way to be able to be independent enough to take care of your financial needs. In the Islamic system, you are supposed to have less stress. Your needs, your financial needs are taken care of. Why? Not that you would sleep longer and just, you know, chit-chat and, you know, have fun, so that it would give you more room
for
peace of mind.
To do what?
To take care of a family.
When?
Whenever it's time for you to get married.
You're a borderline spinster. You still live at your father's house. You do not have a career. You wake up every morning without any life purpose. You sit around for
that. You're a depressed lady. I would say you would have to go see a psychologist, number one. And two, you see in what kind of house this girl is brought up. And
any
what
house.
Kind of community she lives.
Any house.
And what were her the priorities of herself and her parents.
What is her parents' job to do for a 28-year-old, 32-year-old daughter that they have, unmarried, at home, labeled as a spinster, old maid, as the word goes. She doesn't have a career because her daddy takes care of her financial needs.
Where is she living, this girl? I haven't seen such girls. Where in the world is she living?
She lives in Saudi Arabia. She lives in Pakistan. She
I don't think a girl in
Malaysia.
Saudi Arabia would live to be 32 and single.
No, there are a lot.
No, honey. There they have like bunch of like they have polygamy. I don't know about the statistics. If you want to be clear and if you want to talk scientifically, I think we have to go refer to statistics.
No, I'm saying that the image that you're
if
drawing
you're talking
from
about
me
the
right
West,
now, the image that you're drawing from me right now, a girl who's financial needs are taken care of either by her husband or her father so that she could be at peace.
You have
this is the
ostrich
image that comes
picture
to mind.
In your mind. You have the ostrich, exactly.
Elaborate.
So first let me make the picture a little more clear
sure.
Then we can talk
yeah.
about it. So your needs are supposed to be taken care of
mm-hmm.
so that you would have this peace of mind.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, this is the question of the millennium.
Mm-hmm.
Of the century, more precisely to talk.
We're going to be back after a short break, so stay with us.
This is IRIB English Radio. You're listening to Muslim Lady.
Thank you again for joining us. We've been talking about some really interesting stuff.
Sociologists, experts in the field of women and family studies are actually talking, they're discussing this. This is a big question that they have, that what is to become of a woman, of a Muslim woman? We're talking about women. So I am just a researcher in this field. I don't claim that I know the answers to all questions. I'm just saying things based on my studies and based on my personal
for sure,
experience,
for sure.
Right? When I see the situation of girls, of us girls, young, prosperous, educated, having a good career girls, a lot of us, we seem to be enjoying a lot of good things
mm-hmm.
from life these days. But then we're lacking so many other things, fundamental things that I think our religion mm. has had it in its potential. But because we have driven away from that nuclear path, from that important path that we were supposed to follow, we're missing on those things.
Yeah.
For example, depression, being single, for I don't know how long you have to be.
Okay.
These are pains.
Seriously?
These are pains,
depression,
yes.
Depression, I agree, but being single, I don't
for
see
you, it's not a
problem.
Pain, but go ask so many girls who are in their 30s, in their 40s.
Why are they still single, though?
Because they were following their careers, because they wanted to go after education. They became so qualified. They were
overqualified.
And no man would suit them.
Too bad.
You're going to be depressed.
Well, fine.
You're going to be single. You're going to have the dream of having a child until you die. These are pains.
You can solve that with the help of a psychiatrist. I don't understand why.
A psychologist would give you husband and child.
No, they will help you with your depression. But I don't understand.
And then after you get healed.
Why do I have to lower my standards so that a man could catch up with me?
You remember last session? I said that we're giving too much importance to women and women empowerment, and we have left men behind. all these three, four past decades of feminism, women power, whatever, blah, 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 you have given women endlessly, continuously given, pushing women forward to the brinks of success and to the thresholds of, you know,
technology and progression.
Exactly. And men have been left behind.
How is that my problem?
Because the education system, I don't know what you call it, the worldview of people, the doctrines, the prevalent doctrines of the last couple of decades, unfortunately have led the human society, in specific societies, in many societies, in a way, in a direction that the men and women haven't been brought up in a balanced way. So they don't know what is expected of them. They're confused.
And what's the Islam solution to this?
I was drawing a clear line between the Islamic system and the secular system. I said that if you're looking at the solution to this problem is, as you said, in the beginning of our program, you said you either have to choose one of these values or prioritize.
I meant by this, I meant the same thing. If your priority is your hereafter, Sister Razia, and you find that the secular value system is hindering you, is obscuring your path towards this ultimate felicity and salvation of this world and the next, then you're going to pick a side and you choose the Islamic value system. If your priority is success in this world...
This is a very good abstract sentence in a book.
That's why I don't understand.
But then, when you come to life, there are so many variables that would make you shift
and a
your
woman who direction. has been raised in an Islamic household. We're talking about semi-ideal here. She was raised in an Islamic household. Her father and her mother were good, pious, non-abusive, non-absent, really supportive Muslim parents.
Okay.
And she was raised to understand the values of her religion and the do's and the don'ts, the boundaries, the limitations, and the empowering teachings of it, right? Mm-hmm. She really has developed the sense of spiritual growth and really feels that her priority in life is God's satisfaction and my salvation in the hereafter.
So what is she going to do now with this? God's salvation and whatever.
She lives her life in order to attain that objective, right?
How?
In any way she can.
And then whether she has to get married at a young age, she has some suitors?
She has some suitors. She finds someone suitable. She gets married at a young age and she has children. And maybe when her children have grown up, she goes back to college. She does something to keep herself productive and contributing to society. The opportunity doesn't present herself. Doesn't mean she has to sit at home and turn herself into pickle. She can still go do stuff until the opportunity presents itself.
I do agree with
you. Once it does, she compromises and she gravitates towards that which she has prioritized.
Yeah, I totally agree with you.
So that's what I meant by I don't get the confusion.
There is no confusion here.
Okay, good.
Because when you were talking about prioritizing... First of all, you said that she's brought up in a family where she is totally...
She's got her values straight.
And she knows what the roles that she's going to lead in. And she gets married at a young age.
If the opportunity
presents
itself.
This is the part that we didn't agree in the beginning.
If the opportunity presents itself.
The opportunity, well, it's really defining how the opportunity is and how you define suitability of the you know, the suitor. This is the area that where we could have some challenges.
And it's like sort of personal too. We're just gonna have to ask the girl herself.
But then you said she's gonna get married, she's gonna have children, and then she's gonna wait until they grow up, and then she continues her education.
Do whatever it is that she wants to do.
I think this is the Islamic.
Yeah, okay.
This is what Islam wants for you.
Oh, I'm so happy we've come to
problem solved.
Then on the other hand, I've seen a lot of women who grew up with absent fathers, absent mothers, who lost their father at a young age, and that caretaker was no longer available to them to no fault of their own. Mm-hmm. They had to grow up working. They grew up watching their moms working double shifts, triple shifts. They had to get good grades in college so that they could land a good career. and support themselves. And naturally, they would be a tad bit traumatized along the way, not having that father figure to turn to during times of turmoil.
Did they get married?
Some of them did.
Are they happy?
They're happy. They have good... And you know, at the end of the day, everything is rizq. I do believe that. It's a provision. Allah wants to bless someone with a good husband or a good wife. Congratulations. Allah wants to test them with an awful wife or husband.
Rizq is something that is constantly showering everyone. But you're a bowl. You put it upside down. It doesn't receive any rizq.
Yeah, but then Allah, you know, He has a way of testing people.
He tests you with your shortcomings.
Oh, of course.
With your
weaknesses.
Otherwise,
there won't be any growth.
Exactly. This is what... this rizq was always there.
It doesn't necessarily...
You have to create the potential, the capacity in yourself to receive the rizq.
Everyone deserves a good spouse. Well, yes, but sometimes everyone gets tested. Live it out. You live, you learn. You know what I mean?
There were so many other reasons why.
Exactly. I'm saying that
God wanted to maybe test the other people. They wanted to test maybe that woman who married. Or there were so many other
factors
that he wanted to, like, one specific rule or understanding or information for the society, you know, to know it. So these things happen so that because of history, because of the Islamic history, so
yes,
that a specific Islamic rule or a specific Islamic understanding or precept or concept would be understood.
In any case, this is a tricky topic, and I'm glad we came to an understanding of what are the solutions Islam presents for a woman who wishes to live in an Islamic way, right?
But then, I think we still generalize so many things, and that's why we came to a conclusion. We didn't talk about the challenge.
We'll get into more details, inshallah, in future episodes of this show, so make sure to tune in. Thank you for being with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Who is the lover?
Allah.
Who is Ar-Rahman?
Allah.
Who is Al-Mannan?
La ilaha illallah. Muhammad Rasulullah. Muhammad is the messenger. To Allah is our return.
The Quran, given by God to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him and his family, more than 1400 years ago, as guidance for humanity. Quran speaks about women.
The Quran teaches the equality of men and women in the eyes of Allah.
Chapter 33, verse 35.
All praise is due to the one and only. He is the master of all creation.
Modesty and chastity are encouraged by the Quran, both for women and for men.
Chapter 24, verses 30 and 31.
He is the sustainer and the maintainer of the whole universe.
God created us from one male and one female, and made us into nations and tribes, so that we make to know one another, not to despise each other.
Chapter 49, verse 13.
La ilaha illallah, Muhammadur Rasulullah, Muhammad is the messenger, to Allah is our return.
The Quran has indicated worthy women in history just as it has mentioned such men, and has commended them greatly.
Chapter 3, verse 37.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio. log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Limelight. A spat over COVID has exposed friction between former President Donald Trump and a rising GOP governor, Ron DeSantis, who is unwilling to curb his ambitions. The article you're about to hear has been written by New York Times journalists Jonathan Martin, Maggie Haberman, and Jeremy Peters. The piece is titled, "Who is King of Florida? Tensions rise between Trump and a former acolyte." Stay with us for more. For months, former President Donald Trump has been grumbling quietly to friends and visitors to his Palm Beach mansion about a rival Republican power center in another Florida mansion, some 400 miles to the north. Governor Ron DeSantis, a man that Donald Trump believes he put on the map, has been acting far less like an acolyte and more like a future competitor, Mr. Trump complains. With his stock rising fast in the Republican Party, the governor has conspicuously refrained from saying he would stand aside if Donald Trump runs for the Republican nomination for president in 2024. The magic words Trump has said to several associates and advisors. That long stewing resentment burst into public view recently in a dispute over a seemingly unrelated topic, COVID policies. After Ron DeSantis refused to reveal his full COVID vaccination history, the former president publicly acknowledged he had received a booster shot. Last week, he seemed to swipe at Ron DeSantis by blasting as gutless politicians who dodged the question out of fear of blowback from vaccine skeptics. Mr. DeSantis shot back on Friday, 14th of January, criticizing Donald Trump's early handling of the pandemic and saying he regretted not being more vocal in his complaints. The back and forth exposed how far Republicans have shifted to the right on coronavirus politics. The doubts Donald Trump amplified about public health expertise have only spiraled since he left office. Now his defense of the vaccines, even if often subdued and almost always with the caveat in the same breath that he opposes vaccine mandates, has put him uncharacteristically out of step with the hardline elements of his party's base and provided an opening for a rival. But that it was Mr. DeSantis, a once loyal member of the Trump court, wielding the knife made the tension about much more. At his Critics called the dispute amounts to a stand-in for the broader challenge confronting Republicans at the outset of midterm elections. They're led by a defeated former president who demands total fealty, brooks no criticism, and is determined to sniff out and then snuff out any threat to his control of the Republican Party. That includes the 43-year-old Ron DeSantis, who has told friends he believes Donald Trump's expectation that he bend the knee is asking too much. That refusal has set up a generational clash and a test of loyalty in the de facto capital of today's GOP, one watched by Republicans elsewhere who've ridden to power on Mr. Trump's coattails. Already, party figures are attempting to calm matters. "They're the two most important leaders in the Republican Party," said Brian Ballard, a longtime Florida lobbyist with connections to both men, predicting Donald Trump and Ron DeSantis will be personal and political friends for the rest of their careers. Donald Trump's aides also have tried to tamp down questions about the former president's frustrations so as not to elevate Mr. DeSantis. Still, Mr. Trump has made no secret of his preparations for a third run for a White House. And while Ron DeSantis, who is up for re-election this year, has not declared his plans, he is widely believed to be eyeing the presidency. Donald Trump and his aides are mindful of Republicans' increasingly public fatigue with a drama that trails Mr. Trump. The former president's false claims about fraud in the 2020 presidential election, which Ron DeSantis has not challenged, and his role in the events leading to the 6th of January riot at the Capitol have some Republicans looking for a fresh start. Governor Ron DeSantis is often the first name Republicans cite as a possible Trump-style contender not named Trump. DeSantis would be a formidable 2024 candidate in the Trump lane should Donald Trump not run, said Dan Eberhardt, a Republican donor. Eberhardt added, "He's Trump but a little smarter, more disciplined and brusque without being too brusque." Notably, Mr. Trump, a longtime student of charisma and mass appeal, as well as an avid reader of polling, has refrained so far from publicly attacking Ron DeSantis, who is a distant but potent second to him in opinion polls on the 2024 GOP field. His restraint is a break from the mockery and bullying he often uses to attack Republicans that he perceives as vulnerable. Donald Trump made no reference to the Governor DeSantis at a rally in Arizona on Saturday, 15th of January. Mr. DeSantis has $17 million in the bank for his re-election, a war chest he stocked with the help from the Republican rank-and-file and donor class alike. He has raised his profile in the same spaces that Mr. Trump once dominated. The governor is ubiquitous on Fox News Channel, where he is routinely met with a sort of softballs that once arced towards Mr. Trump. And he frequently mixes with the well-tanned Republican donor community near the former president's winter home in South Florida. But it was not always this way. Ron DeSantis was a little-known Florida congressman back in 2017 when Donald Trump, who was then the president, spotted him on television and took keen interest in him. Mr. DeSantis, an Ivy League-educated military veteran and smooth-talking defender of the new president, was exactly what Donald Trump liked in a politician. It wasn't long before Donald Trump blessed Ron DeSantis's bid for governor and sent in staff to help him, lifting the lawmaker to a victory over a better-known rival for the party's nomination. Ron DeSantis survived the general election and has often governed in a style that mirrors his patron, slashing at the left and scrapping with the news media. But that alone doesn't placate Donald Trump. As with other Republicans he has endorsed, the former president appears to take a kind of ownership interest in Mr. DeSantis and to believe that he's owed dividends and deference. Look, I helped Ron DeSantis at a level that nobody's ever been before, Donald Trump said in an interview for a forthcoming book, Insurgency, on the Rightward Shift of the Republican Party, by the New York Times reporter Jeremy Peters. Donald Trump said he believed Mr. DeSantis didn't have a chance of winning without his help. The former president's expectation of deference from Mr. DeSantis is a reminder to other Republicans that a Trump endorsement comes with a price, a demand that could prove particularly consequential should he run again and have a stable of Republican lawmakers in his debt. At times, Donald Trump has sought to kindle his relationship with Ron DeSantis. He has suggested the governor would be a strong choice for vice president. Similar courtship has helped win deference from other potential rivals, but Mr. DeSantis has not relented. I wonder why the guy won't say he won't run against me, Donald Trump has said to several associates and advisors who spoke on condition of anonymity to describe private conversations. Mr. Trump began the recent contretemps for attacking the governor's refusal to acknowledge whether he had received the COVID-19 booster shot. The answer is yes, but they don't want to say it because they're gutless, Donald Trump said in a television interview this month, referring only to politicians but clearly alluding to Ron DeSantis. You've got to say it, whether you had it or not. Say it. Mr. DeSantis' response came on Friday, 14th of January, in an interview on the conservative podcast Ruthless. Speaking in front of an in-person audience near St. Petersburg, Florida, the governor said one of his biggest regrets was not forcefully opposing Donald Trump's calls for lockdowns when the coronavirus first began to spread in the spring of 2020. Knowing now what I know then, if that was a threat earlier, I would have been much louder, Mr. DeSantis said. The governor said he had been telling Trump stop the flights from China, but argued he never thought in early March of 2020 that the coronavirus would lead to locking down the country. Mr. DeSantis then moved quickly to placate blame on Dr. Anthony Fauci, who advised Donald Trump on the country's COVID response, a much safer target with conservatives. The former president did not immediately respond. Without a Twitter account, his hair-trigger retorts have become much less frequent. A spokesman for Donald Trump also did not respond to requests for comment. An advisor to Ron DeSantis also declined to comment.
Iranian news, Iranian culture, Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio.